Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin is home to the nation's only Master Cheesemakers program that provides innovative cheesemakers with continuing education opportunities? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to Speaking Broadly. This is your host, Dana Cowan. And today I am thrilled to have as my guest someone whose cooking I've enjoyed for years. First, when she was working with April Bloomfield at the Breslin, then at John Dory Oyster Barn. I didn't know that was a tongue twister until I just tried that.
It's a little difficult.
It's a little difficult. Okay, White Gold Butcher, which happens to be one block or two blocks from my house, and now as executive chef at Reynard, which is in the Wyeth Hotel in Brooklyn. Welcome, Christina Leckie.
Thanks for having me, Dana.
I am excited to have you here for so many reasons. I mean, from uni toes to bone broth to wood-roasted squash, which is your latest absolute stroke of genius as far as I'm concerned. And we'll get to food later. But one reason I was so thrilled to have you in that chair right by my side is to hear what it's like to, you know, take the helm now that you are executive chef. So to understand that, I think we have to understand a little bit about what it was like to work for April, because how many years did you work with April Bloomfield?
Like close to seven, maybe like seven, like a full, yeah. Yeah, a long time.
That's a lot. And yeah, you got to do three separate openings.
Yeah, three separate openings, yeah.
And so what was that like?
Challenging. A lot of work, a lot of hours, but good. I mean,
was the challenging part?
Challenging because I guess when you first start working with somebody is understanding their sensibilities and their visions. And then once you sort of understand that, which I feel like why April and I were so successful together is because we sort of had a kindred friendship and work relationship. I think she had a lot of respect for me. I had a lot of respect for her. And
what was the vision? Like, how could you articulate the vision that you had in common?
I think very high standards, hard work, dedication, being very consistent with our cooking. Like, she could come in and be rest assured that the kitchen would be running the way that she would be running it if she had been there. And I think for me, it worked really well because I sort of was looking for someone to trust me and sort of let me kind of run and do my own thing. And I think because I built that trust with her, I was able to sort of, I had a lot of creative control and a lot of freedom. And, you know, and I think, like I said, through mutual respect and I really believe consistency.
Can be so hard in the kitchen.
Yeah, totally.
You know, that notion of doing the roast chicken the exact same way every day. Like, I've never achieved consistency ever.
It's probably the most challenging thing. Yeah.
What's the key? Like, how do you get consistency?
I think, hopefully dialing in a recipe and sort of sticking with that recipe, but also teaching people about sensibilities. Like, is this garlic taste the way garlic should? And I feel like April really instilled that in me. She had such a highly sensitive palate for that lemon doesn't taste like lemon, you know, like saying things that like most people wouldn't think of, you know. She really understands the nuances, and I think that's why her food shines so brightly, because it's the little things that she's always paying attention to. And I think I always knew that about my own cooking, but I think she really like drove that home and made that a thing. So, you know, yes, there's roasted pumpkin, but maybe these pump, like from this farm, they're not as sweet as these others. So it's really making sure you're building those foundations and tasting in addition to like coming up with a precise recipe. And I think teaching a staff in a way that one will, they'll get behind your vision and always, you know, gently nudging them to continue to be like, okay, it's not quite like this, you know, and tasting the food on a regular basis, I think is huge.
I love the notion of a lemon not tasting like lemon because, yeah, of course, ingredients, you know, depending on the season, depending on the weather, that darn weather,
totally,
which, you know, where things come from.
Yeah.
The notion that you can just follow a recipe blindly is just, you know, kind of a bad idea. And in, yeah, a restaurant, being able to do that on the fly is so important. When you were working in those great kitchens, how did you feel about being the behind-the-scenes person? And did you sort of ache to be the in-front-of-the-scenes person?
I never really knew what... I always knew I wanted to be a chef, and I always knew that I wanted to be recognized in some way for my hard work. And I feel like April, in her way, did allow me to blossom. And be, like I said, because I was often by myself, obviously she's running a very large organization, and, you know, she'd be bouncing around to all the places, but she wouldn't be there in a long time. So I think for a long time I'd forgotten about, like, oh yeah, like this is her, you know, like this isn't really me. But I think it's crazy not to sort of, when you know that you're giving so much of yourself, to not at some point sort of put yourself out there. Because it's really, I mean, it's like why we're, you know, it's like what drives you is like, besides like motivation from a boss or a peer, but like it's yourself, you know? And I think for me, it's really exciting and sort of scary, but I love the fear, you know, like it drives me. And so I feel really good about it. And, you know, there's always like a part of me that's like, God, I guess I could have done that sooner. But like, I feel like everything happens for a reason, and timing is, you know, it's been a good transition.
So how do you find fear as a motivator? Like, what does that, what does that mean to you?
Well, I think it's a way that kitchens used to run very successfully for a very long time. And I was definitely part of that. I always like to call it one of the last generations of these like old school, sort of very domineering, demanding, often feeling loveless, yet thriving on like, you know, sheer fear and hunger to please the boss and please the customers, as a line cook, you know.
So you were in Philadelphia doing that, right?
I was in Philadelphia and time in New York as well, yeah.
Right, so
Striped Bass, yeah.
And Gilt, yeah. Who was the chef at Gilt when you were there?
It was a chef called Christopher Lee. And then my friend Justin Bogle took it over, who's the CDC at Le Cuckoo. Yeah.
I hadn't put that together.
Yeah.
Right, I remember when Christopher was there, and that you had worked with him at Striped Bass also,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
So you have managed to find a way to impress these chefs enough that they keep you on,
yeah,
from city to city,
yeah,
and project to project.
Yeah. I definitely say cooking didn't come naturally to me, although it's what I sort of lean towards. It took me a long time to sort of blossom.
Why do you think that is?
It took me longer to chop things correctly, and it took me longer to just understand the nuances and drive. But
why did you persevere? Like, if it took you so long, you know, people tend to gravitate towards the things that they do well, that,
yeah,
feel easy for them. But
I think I had an answer for that a second ago. I think I think for me it was, I mean, just sheer determination to do a good job. I think another reason, you know, and this is what I wanted to say really, is, you know, I didn't show a lot of emotion in the kitchen. And I think I was doing an okay job, but I think I didn't show the fear that I was feeling. And I never cried. I didn't, like, get emotional. And I think early on, my early bosses thought that I wasn't passionate. They took that as a sign of dispassion. And I always felt like I was, like, I remember burning a loaf of brioche that the pastry chef had made, was so embarrassed to tell them that I went out and ran out and bought a loaf of brioche, wow, to like replay, you know, that's like the kind of integrity and like heart, like I knew that it was there. So for me, I was never deterred. I think I had to figure out a way to find my own voice in the kitchen and find a way to get people to understand that I did care.
And why is it that you think they thought, I'm not saying you would agree, that crying would have been a sign of passion. Was that just the
I think it was culture? The nature of the, yeah, I think it was like, you know, people crumbling under pressure and showing emotion or showing fear, you know, I think it was, you know, there was a little bit of that to it, you know, and, you know, obviously I didn't start that long ago, but, you know, women weren't, you know, that regular in the kitchen. There was definitely mostly always in pastry and like the old classic stuff that people say. And I don't know. I just sort of wanted to really assimilate and like be one of the guys and not sort of, you know, I didn't want to like crumble. And I just think maybe they didn't really know how to manage that, you know, and I think, like I said, once I got it, yeah. I excelled pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
So you were working when you were working for at the Breslin, John Dory, much less so, I think, at White Gold probably. Yeah. The Umbrella Restaurant Group was run by Ken Friedman, who has faced sexual harassment charges. It's been really sort of devastating in a lot of different ways. I wonder, you know, when you were inside that organization, which you are not now, but what did that feel like? Is that something, because you were just talking about like the intensity of the kitchen and people who want to make you crumble. This is a different way of feeling intensity, protecting yourself from intensity. What was that like?
I think I turned it off for a really long time. And I think it eventually got the better of me, and it's why I'm not there any longer. And I think it's a shame, and I think it's a bigger problem. You know, obviously we know it's like we're just hitting the tip of a giant, you know, iceberg. And I think we all knew that there was some sort of something that wasn't quite right, and there was some level of uncomfortability that was always sort of present. And I think you just, you know, as somebody, as a female, and I think many females will feel the same, is you're so programmed to ignore sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. Like, I started my working career. I was a busser. I was a hostess. I've always sort of gravitated for money in restaurants. And you sort of just turn it off. You know, it's like how you get catcalled on the street. You just sort of, you just brush it off. And I think, I mean, what's so amazing now is like that doesn't have to be the norm anymore. And it you can look at it as a real problem instead of just being like, oh, well, that's just what people do, you know.
So it sounds like in some way you identify with what April was saying at the beginning, which was her first response, I guess is a better way to say it, which is, you know, you do what you can, but you basically ignore it.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it was a hard thing to turn off, or just like you're so programmed?
I think I was often protected because he was never my direct boss, but there were times that I felt uncomfortable and I'd wish that I had spoken up sooner. And I feel like, you know, I feel like I'm in a really great place right now, and I feel like, you know, hopefully someday April will be able to tell her side of, you know, what's gone on in her company. And I think, you know, I think she herself is dealing with a lot of, you know, like, you know, how did this, you know, how has this been going on for so long?
It's got to take a lot of reflection and time. And, you know, I think all of us look back one way or another and say, what could I have done? I mean, certainly in my position at Food and Wine, you know, there's questions that arise in my mind. You know, are there people that I could have given less attention to, or, you know, pursued the rumors, or, you know, I don't know, because I don't think that pursuing rumors, that's complicated.
Sure.
But it also does make me look forward, as you were saying, in a different way. A much more heightened awareness of what I can do to contribute to positively.
Sure.
And certainly now at Reynard, you still have a boss. Yeah. It's like you don't get to do the entire thing on your own. So, and I know that you lead your kitchen in a way that is a repudiation of the uncomfortableness that you describe at, you know, some of those restaurants where you worked earlier. How do you create sort of an ideal environment. And it isn't ideal, right? No environment is actually ideal. But your best shot at it.
I don't know. For me, it's like, as a chef, I feel like, again, talking about like trends of things, like behavior patterns of older times, you know, and I think a lot of young managers go through this where you're a little more hot-headed, you're a little more aggressive because you feel like that's the way to get your point across, and that's also the way that you've been shown because that's how people got their point across to you. And for me, as I mature in my career, I feel like I'm able to relax a lot more and look at the bigger picture and sort of try to just build a trust and understanding with my staff that they know that I'm there for them and that I am going to hold them accountable for things. And I think for me, just being a very consistent manager, so they know what the expectation is. So there's less need to get so angry or get so aggressive. And also just trying to have my staff, like if they're going through a personal problem or they're feeling, you know, is a dishwasher or another, a fellow cook, like treating them in a certain way that's not correct, like that they know that that I'm a safe environment for them to sort of, you know, give, like talk to and sort of like sound off about problems that they might be having inside and outside of work. I mean, they are giving a lot of their time to their career and to me, quite frankly, and I owe it to them to sort of offer, you know, in addition to a job and hopefully a future in this industry, but as, you know, as a personal counsel in some kind of way and like some personal advice. I think what I love about the new generation is that they are much more sensitive and they're more open to talking about their sensitivities than I was raised. And I admire that. I think there's a courageousness to that. And there's a real sincerity to it. And I try to nurture my staff as much as possible and just give them a broader experience than I'd been given.
It's interesting because you bring up the notion of, you know, bringing your personal life into the restaurant in part because your team probably works, you know, a lot of their time. And in the old days, and in many work environments, so it's not just restaurants, you're supposed to really leave your personal life outside. Do you feel like it's specific to restaurants that you do want to talk to the whole person because of the mental health issues or the just the physical grueling problems how it affects your ability to have relationships? Yeah. Do you think that's influenced you? And
I think so. I mean, I definitely, for me, try to tamper down the hours. Like, I mean, obviously labor is so much more expensive than it was, but I mean, also obviously it can be quite grueling and it can be quite exhausting. And I do think you're not getting the best out of your employee, you know, forcing them to work X amount of hours and for good or bad, you almost can't afford to have people work those kind of hours anymore. So I think with them working less, and I do think there's a lot of mental health issues that, you know, you could never really talk about that people really are experiencing. I mean, if you're working late nights, you know, you're working, you know, you might, you know, it's a very loose and fast, it still has that sort of party vibe and, you know, people can get mixed up in a lot of things, you know, and I do think that you have to be aware, like if you know a cook is coming in and they seem kind of off, I mean, that's going to affect the food, right? That's going to affect a customer's experience. Like I have to get to the bottom of that before or after service if I've noticed something, because inevitably it's going to hurt what's coming out of the kitchen if everybody's not like giving it 100%. Like you literally need them to be on like sharp-minded and focused, or you're not going to have the best service, and it's going to sort of drag everybody down, and it's certainly going to drag the quality of food down. So I feel like those things are so they go such hand in hand that it is
interesting that up until this, up and through this time, there have been people cooking the food who are, you know, stoned, angry, exhausted.
Yeah.
And yet we've had some really amazing food.
Sure, I know. It's like, and why can't we still have that? I mean, I guess you could. I mean, I don't know. I always like to joke and say I don't drink and drive the ship. Like, I've never been a fan of that. I feel like I saw that very, very early on in my career of, like, chefs, like, partying on the line. And I was just like, that's not why I got into this. I got into it for, like, the creativity and, like, the, you know, like, the more higher end aspect of it. But yeah, I mean, I am glad it's not like that because I don't think I would have survived. I'm glad to have like definitely been in real professional kitchens, and I try to like, you know, keep that and moving forward.
So another hot button of the moment is the tipping, no tipping. And Reynard is a no tipping restaurant. How's that working out for the team? And
I mean, for me, well, it's
back of the house doesn't really affect it. But
well, it does in the sense that like we can pay staff a little more. You know, it makes a more even playing field between the front and the back of the house. It's no longer like they're, you know, walking out with a big wad of cash and the kitchen's making minimum wage, and it definitely broadens the labor pool and like allows us to hire at a higher hourly than like I feel like a restaurant that's not. I mean, but it definitely costs the, you know, it's a business sacrifice for sure, and you can see why it's not working out for everybody. And you
and
know
the sacrifice is
because if the business is not making, then you're personally paying for the higher wages. But if the business is obviously making, thriving and making all the money that it, you know, you sort of set out for it to make with the gratuity free, then, you know, it pays for itself. But it you know, it's a tricky balance. It definitely puts, you know, it definitely takes some dedication and some like real, I mean, I'm still learning. It's obviously a very new system to me. And, you know, but Andrew is very much, Andrew Tarlow is very much, you know, he's for it, and I can see why in a lot of ways, but it's definitely like a business sacrifice. Like it's not an easy.
What do you think the future is? Do you think that because it's been such a mixed bag?
I know.
And so
I
many
think the
restaurants.
Future has to be something. I don't know if that's. I don't know if that's the end all be all, but I definitely think with the way that the labor, you know, like by 2018 it'll be $16-$15 in New York, and obviously it's already been that way in California. I mean, I know that my friends who have restaurants in San Francisco. And the servers make such a high hourly, and the tipping on top. I mean, the labor is outrageous, and restaurants just simply aren't making any money, you know, because you're paying so much staff. And then the kitchen and front of the house imbalance gets greater and greater. Like servers are making $100,000 a year, and the kitchen staff's still making $40,000 or $45,000. You know, it's such a huge imbalance. And I've had chefs in San Francisco tell me that they've lost kitchen staff to go to the front of the house because they see where the money is going, and you know, and that's a shame. And yeah, you know, sadly I'm not very like financially savvy enough to have smart answers for those kind of questions, but I mean, as we know, running a business is getting just so much more increasingly expensive between cost of products and cost of labor and, you know, cost of rents.
It'll be interesting to see where it all yeah. lands, whether it'll be, you know, all fine dining and then
the fast casual. Or like, yeah, the places that are in the, like, the halls and the food courts and the...
Right.
I hope it doesn't go that way. I sort of really... Those are my least favorite.
Something that's replicated where you don't have the soul of the chef in your food.
I don't like those. Yeah, those are not for me, but... And I'd hate to see this industry go in that kind of way. I get sort of like the community and like the cheaper spaces, and it's sort of like a satellite to a bigger thing. But I do think it does. You really don't feel the passion or the spirit of a place in a little stall somewhere.
And do you feel that it changes your experience of what you're eating?
Yeah. Yeah, I went to a couple even in Copenhagen where people were like, oh, yeah, like the, and I'm just like, it's not good there either. Like, it's not like they figure, I mean, maybe they think, I don't think they figured something out with it either. I don't particularly care for it.
And with that thought, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we will be right back with Executive Chef Christina Lecky.
Thanks so much.
Take a sip from your chalice, chest, and I bow my head to you. 'Cause kicking myself would be a waste of...
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin Cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. cheese curds literally anyway, anytime, anyplace. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sutari's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly. This is your host, Dana Cowan, and today I have with me Christine Leckie, who is the executive chef at Reynard in Brooklyn in the Wyeth Hotel. If you haven't been, you have to go. I went on, I think, truly the coldest night of the year.
We've had a few, but and, yeah, that was a particularly cold night.
And I was wrapped and bundled and... that was fine. I got through the door. But what was so great was that once I got through the door and was ready to eat, I walked into the kitchen because there's Christina at the pass. And or maybe you might have been not exactly at the pass. But there's a wood hearth and these amazing roasted cauliflowers and roast chicken and roast squash. It's a roast fest.
And I'm
excited to talk about your food and the inspiration behind your food. I know that you went to have Francis Mallmann's food in Argentina.
Yeah.
And was that part of preparing you for your next gig, preparing you for this? Because I think where were you then?
I was working, where was I then? I think we were in transition to opening White Gold.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I was slated to help, and I did work on a little bit The Hearth and the Hound. So
Hearth and the Hound, which is in
Los Angeles. So we went on a little research trip.
April Bloomfield.
Yeah. She called up Francis and was like, "Hey, do you mind if we come and check you out?" And he's like, "Yes, I'm going to be on vacation by myself in Patagonia. Would you like to come?" And it was sort of like, I give April so much credit for sort of arranging that trip, because it was definitely a trip of a lifetime. We were there for 2 weeks and we didn't have cell phone service or, you know.
What was that like?
We were really isolated. It was amazing. I mean, I think it was harder. Maybe April, I don't want to speak for her too much, but I think it was a struggle at first. But I think, you know, we definitely sort of, you know, it's definitely nice to turn off. Like, if anybody has not ever just really shut it off for even a week, I think it's really important for you to, get back into your own brain fully, you know. But it was amazing. I mean, we got to see a lot of cooking techniques, got to experience just such a pure environment.
So describe it to me, because I've never been.
It's crystal clear, kind of grayish water, grayish in the sense that just the color of it is just not very bright, but so clear you can see the reflections of the mountains shine directly on there. You dig the soil and it's immediately this beautiful rich clay, like almost at a spa you would slather this clay all over yourself. It's just so wonderful. There's beautiful rainbow and brook trout in the waters. And, you know, we got to go towards the end of their winter. So there was still snow on the ground, but it was our summer, which was a great sort of in August to go and be bundle up and go ski cross-country skiing and fly fishing and, you know, get to build all these fires, wake up in the morning and it was great.
So we stayed. Tell me about building fires with Francis Mallmann, because of course he wrote that extraordinary book on the seven fires. And what did you learn from doing that?
I learned that it takes a lot of patience, but it also just takes knowing what to look for.
And what do you look for?
Different types of how to shave wood off a tree to get the right kind of shavings to light. to build a small fire and make it bigger,
And why does that matter?
I think it matters because you need, you got to start with a lot of like almost kindling or like little, it's like going in the forest and foraging for the right amount of dry wood. And then, building like, Francis is obviously the most romantic and, he talks about it like you're building an altar and, you got to have a nice foundation and then you start building it up and up. And, I'm sure I in the wild will need a lot more practice, but it was, it was great to sit there and just sort of absorb his intensity towards what he does and his passion for it. I mean, he's an over-the-top passionate, dedicated to his craft and obviously extremely romantic in the way that he talks about things, which makes it,
And what is for those who don't know about Malman's romanticism, how do you describe that?
It's flowery, flourishing words and, he's very well read. He's very, well spoken and, he just exudes passion and energy. He's got such a vibrant youthfulness that, is sort of.
So did you take any of those techniques back to?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, it's a little different working in an indoor because he's definitely, I think the magic of Francis is being on location with Francis. And when Francis does his like pop-ups in the wild, I think those are or out in the world, like when he goes to Napa and stuff like that and like does things in the woods, those are the real, I think that's where you see the like amazing uniqueness of his cuisine. But definitely, understanding that like you can cook something for many hours over wood and it not pick up a lot of smoke and understanding how difficult it is to sort of really, and the nuances can be really small, and just.
I thought that was interesting because I know that you've said in the cooking that you do at Reynard, you're controlling for the smoke. I mean, yeah. You're not really trying to blast.
Yeah, it's not like a barbecue. It's not meant to be like a smokehouse, But I am trying to work on building the smoky flavors a little more because it is quite a challenge. Like certainly you can put a char on stuff and certainly you can, you can cook things, but it's like, how do you make sure you're capturing all of the essence of the wood, like the wood, not just providing a heating source, utilizing it for, for all of its purposes. So we try to do a lot of hanging. So while things are cooking, we're also smoking some other things. So there's a balance between the two. And if maybe one thing's been grilled, the other thing on the plate has been smoked. So you get like a nice, subtle balance.
And one of my favorite dishes of yours is that roasted squash, which I think partly is the squash itself. Because sure. I'm so accustomed, we've tripped into a world of delicata squash rings. But that's really not your squash.
Yeah.
Can you tell listeners a little bit about your extraordinary squash. It's a kombucha.
Yeah, it's funny. Squash is one of those things that I sort of ignored for a couple. Chef, I feel like all chefs must do this, where they forget about a vegetable for a while because they either the world itself has oversaturated them or they themselves are oversaturated by cooking. And I definitely hadn't cooked with pumpkin or squash in a really long time. And for some reason, it just felt, I think maybe this year we just got such a good batch of red curry squashes and kombucha squashes. And I sort of like them because the texture of the meat is so dry and so rich. They're not sort of like delicate and watery. I mean, but they do have a sweetness in their concentration. And I think you can really concentrate them overnight with the I have a wood grill or wood hearth as well and a wood stove. So I'm able to use the end of the night embers to cook them for the next day. And I think that does really sort of dry them up even a little more and really intensify their sweetness. I mean, you can tell they're just such a dark orange, rich, kind of a flaky almost. They almost have like a flaky, like a puff pastry layered to them.
I think what's so interesting too is that they seem very primordial.
Yeah.
They're not a sort of delicate with a delicate skin. And
they have kind of a rough skin. Yeah, and we sort of like to just tear them open and just keep them all like jagged. And
I really love that jagged
quality. Like where the edges get a little burnt and crispy, yeah.
Did that feel daring to do? Because I feel like it's super unchefy, and yet it was part of what I responded to the most. Like, I hadn't seen it before. I was really excited to try it. And then, of course, it tastes delicious.
Yeah.
But the visual of being craggy and dry and dark orange was amazing.
Yeah, thanks. I do kind of like things just kind of torn open and like put on a plate, I guess, in a way that doesn't look like just thrown on, but not overly fussed with. And I think I learned a lot of that. April likes to do that a bit as well.
Right. One of the things about April's food, when you read her recipes, you realize how precise she is.
Yeah.
Because what ends up on your plate doesn't always have that visual precision.
Sure.
But it has flavor precision.
Sure.
Precision, which I really admire. You were talking about vegetables that were forgotten, and then, of course, some vegetables are so ridiculously of the moment. I wonder how a chef even conceives to, you know, embrace them. And in your menu, the cauliflower is the one.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh boy, cauliflower again. But it was great. Can you talk about your cauliflower and how you embraced cauliflower, even in a cauliflower moment in history?
Yeah, cauliflower's been a moment for a long time. I mean, luckily, it's not deep fried and it's not battered. So, you know, I think we're...
You're safe there.
We're trendsetting. Just kidding. In that regard, no. But we, you know, we steam ours a little bit just to get them started, and then toss them in a garlic confit, and then just throw them as close to the embers as possible in the wood oven, and let them sort of naturally char. And then I think because it's served with, you know, a dish that like, or an ingredient that I don't often see on menus, which is a soca or farinata, which is a chickpea crepe, which I think for me, I love because I love that area of France, and I love the idea of how European it is. But I also love that it's gluten-free, and it like saves me a lot of trouble as a chef on a menu to be like, not only do I have this delicious thing, but it's also gluten-free.
Right.
Like, and it, you just and, check and it's vegetarian, and it's like, yeah, it's like it's a crowd pleaser for people who have dietary issues, I think. And it's delicious. You know, you get to fry it in a lot of really, really delicious good olive oil. And yeah, I think because I have that, the ovens that I have, and yeah, it's a fun thing to have, and I think it'd be one of those things that maybe cauliflower will be moving very soon off that, thank God, and you know, maybe I can just serve that as like a bread side or like a, you know, because it just would be always nice to sort of have that like crispy, oily, you know, chickpea
for the soca.
Yeah.
And so if cauliflower moves off the menu, just as a general proposition, not yours, what vegetable do you think is poised to take its place?
Yeah, let's say food forecasting 2018.
I always love food. Of course, you can imagine. I love food forecasting.
I know. God, I should have been thinking about this. I mean, I think cabbage is going to continue to have a rise. I do think there's a lot more cabbage, and I think farmers are growing a lot more varietals. Like Caraflex cabbage is like something that has won my heart and would be a new vegetable that I would use religiously moving forward for a while until I get oversaturated with it. But
I don't even know what that is.
Caraflex cabbage is like a cone-shaped cabbage. Oh. And I first saw it in California in the farmers markets in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And then miraculously this winter, for the first time in abundance, maybe it was around like, you know, the farmers, you know, what's great about going to the markets all the time or having relationships with farmers, you can see they experiment with a lot of stuff. Like they'll be like, oh, we just planted this little crop of, you know, and just to see if the chefs go for it. And sometimes the chefs go for it and the consumers go for it. And sometimes they don't, so they don't grow as much of it. But, I think that...
What else fits in that category? I'm curious.
Let me think. I think aji dulce is a pepper that was like... That's something that I feel like is relatively newish, like within the past like 3 years. Like it's like a habanero with... it's got all the habanero like fruitiness, but none of the heat.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that like... I think it was kind of around a little. And then like once the chef sort of caught onto it, like... really began to boom, like buying pounds and pounds and pounds of it. And I like to use it on it's a good little like additive. Like it's like, oh, what's that? Because it's not something that I think as a as a diner that you don't see those in the grocery store as much. But I think you're slowly starting. People call them seasoning peppers as well. So I think you're slowly starting to see them. But yeah, what's going to be big for this year? Cooey, I don't know. I couldn't answer that question.
Well, you just answered you answered it with two that I think are.
I think really, those will continue to like sort of
They're great. You've said that a couple of places that I think you staged. I'm not sure you worked, but River Cafe. These restaurants have a feminine touch.
Yeah,
I'm wondering what you mean by that because. You know, the idea that food is either feminine or masculine is intriguing to me.
I think. it's the way that the food is touched, and it's using like sometimes softer ingredients or not like beating somebody over the head with spice or with and maybe I'm a woman, so I'm biased now that I think about how pointed this is, but you know, it's like oregano over marjoram. I would say marjoram's a more feminine herb than oregano. You know, I think it's soft. It's like sweeter and softer. And I guess that I feel like I'm like almost poorly stereotyping women in a way. But I don't know. It's just, it's about subtleties and like a delicateness. And I think you see that with a lot of really incredible, like Suzanne Gaunt. Like there's just
Suzanne Gaunt in Los Angeles.
Yeah. There's just like, there's a way that women touch food that is inherently different than a lot of men. Not all men, but a lot of men.
I'm actually surprised sometimes to see that the plating of men in the fancy restaurants can be exceptionally refined.
Yeah.
And women tend actually to not gravitate to that arena of fine dining.
Sure.
I think, I don't want to generalize.
I know.
It's horrible. We're tripping into it. But I'd read that you'd said that, and it interests me. I think women tend to have a more honest relationship with the food, which means a little bit less fussery from, you know, but not always.
I just think, even as like a line cook, I just think that there's a little more, I think it's a little more like a softer touch. Like even watching men to women, like dress salads, it's like, you know, you really have to teach, I mean, they're, you know, just how to like touch things and hold things and be gentle with things. And I don't know, does it come naturally to women more than men, or have I just been trained by really great women, and I also worked with really great men? I don't know. But I do think there is a difference, and I do think there are ingredients, and there's just a softer balance sometimes. I do think women are slightly savvier in that way about like getting a lot of flavor out of something without like overtly
bonking you on the head. I think that was that was where we were going with that comment. So, I'm wondering, you've worked for, as you just said, lots of women. Is there a woman who has stood out to you as an extraordinary mentor? Someone who, beyond April, because I think that she's clearly been a tremendous inspiration and support, but in an unusual space. Because one thing that I love to do on Speaking Broadly is to just say the names and honor the work of women, just because the more stories we tell and the more names we share, the more power we have. And so I'm wondering if someone comes to mind.
I think on a more high level scale, it would be Nancy Silverton has always been somebody who's just, you know, she's just, and when you're in a room with her, she's just so welcoming and so friendly, even if you're like the dishwasher. Like I just watched the way that she behaves with all of her staff, and even me having just come into her spaces and doing events, she's always just sort of like, without really knowing me, always felt like she had taken me under her wing. And I just think that's her being in the position that she's in and having the knowledge that she has as a powerful female chef, is just so open with knowledge and guidance really effortlessly, which I think is really remarkable and something to aspire to. And then for me, it's just, I think it's all the women that I've worked with over the years that, you know, the unsung heroes, and just watching how hard they work and the dedication. You know, the woman who's the chef at the John Dory, Charlene Santiago, she's a single mom, and she, you know, she is so caring about the food that she does at that space. And, you know, she works so hard and so tirelessly for making sure that place runs smoothly and picks up so many extra hours. And, you know, her dedication and her work ethic is something that I truly admire. And then I'll butcher her name, but her name is Berju, and she's got a restaurant called the Le French Diner in the Lower East Side. And she's another one. She's a woman from Turkey, and she was a sous chef of mine at the John Dory. And she works like a complete silent ninja in this kitchen. If anybody ever gets there, it's a kind of an amazing feat to watch her work. It's the cleanest, tiniest little kitchen you've ever seen, and she's putting out just beautiful, wholesome French classics in a way that's
That makes me want to go.
Yeah.
So tell me the name again.
Her name is Berchu, and I will never pronounce
that's
her
okay,
last name.
That's okay, but the restaurant name.
It's called Le French Diner.
Le French Diner.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, it's in the Lower East Side, and she's another, like, just a wonderful, such a hardworking, soft-spoken person.
Okay, one last round, which is, you know, you've worked incredibly hard. You've overcome some things that are really challenging, like I loved reading... I'm sorry to say I love reading, that you had dropped out of culinary school,
yeah.
Right? So, but you found your determination. And for the listeners, like, what do you think is the guiding light? Like, what is the best advice that anyone has ever given you?
Wow. I feel like I think the is not to give up and to just, I told, like, pull up your bootstraps and sort of just... like get the job done. But I do think, I honestly think a lot of it just comes from within. And I think just being and surrounding myself with really good, smart people who maybe they were always a little bit better than me and me just always sort of like, if I'd surround myself with the right people, I too someday would be the right person.
Okay. I really love that thought. I'm going to end right there. So, Christina, thank you for joining me. If people want to find you on social, how do they do that?
I don't have Facebook, but I have Instagram, Christina Lecky. Instagram. I don't know. But yeah, I'm almost going to give you my personal email. But
no, but you can also just see her in person. How many nights a week are you at the restaurant?
Like 5 to 6 right now, but mostly 5. It's been really good.
That's good. That's good. That's you holding back.
Yeah.
So check out the, I mean, we described a few of those dishes. Her food is both nuanced and really just happy, happy, delicious food. And you know where to find me, Dana Cowan. You can find me at FW Scout on Twitter and on Instagram. And I want to thank my amazing engineer, David Tatasciore, and Carlin Thompson, who helps me be me across all channels. And I just saw my daughter's face pop in the window. Sylvie nice. Palmer, really glad you came to visit today. Okay, guys, that's it for...
Can I just say one thing?
Oh, please.
I just wanted to say thank you for always supporting and being around and being just a happy support for women in general, because you yourself... You know, you're in the, you've been doing it for women for a really long time. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for that. Okay. I like ending on that even better. So join us again next week and look forward to having you back on Speaking Broadly. That being you listeners, not Christina. Like, this is her one shot for the year. Okay, guys. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.